It's time for Forward Nation Radio. Now here he is, the host of Forward Nation Radio, David Leventhal.
Trump supporters accuse NPR of inciting a treasonous uprising against the president. How? By tweeting out the Declaration of Independence. Let me say that again. Trump supporters accuse NPR of inciting a treasonous uprising against the president by tweeting the Declaration of Independence. So patriotism this July 4th means, very clearly, support for the president and not support for the Declaration of Independence. Welcome to Trump land. Also, welcome to Forward Nation Radio with me, David Leventhal. And we will not be reciting the Declaration of Independence because we don't want to be accused of being treasonous. Anyway, thanks for joining us as always on today's show. We will be talking about the not unexpected Supreme Court pick, a little bit more about civility. But first, let's go back to talking about treason. The president of the United States, Donald Trump, maybe we should just call him the Trumpster. Like some frat boy nickname would seem to suit him better than President Trump. The Trumpster is in Europe right now, meeting with our allies, Vladimir Putin and his staff, and also our enemies, NATO. That's the way it seems to be going right now with the president of the United States, who was pointed out right before he left, noted where he was going to be, going to attend a NATO meeting, and then was going to meet ultimately with Vladimir Putin, and said meeting with Putin should be the easy part.
It's almost like the whole thing is just an excuse to meet with Vladimir Putin.
Well, he probably was summoned.
Yeah, but what's the point? You go to Europe and then you're just going to insult all of our allies?
Well, maybe that's the point. Maybe you're missing the big point. That there really is an intentional realignment by the United States of America, the President of the United States. This is an assault on the post-World War II world order. I mean, let's be clear on what's happening here. He is absolutely making enemies of all of our allies since basically World War II. The so-called freedom-loving democracies of the world, our longtime friends, he has a real problem with and he's alienating.
Unbelievable.
But someone like Vladimir Putin, that's okay. This is, the impact of this is extraordinary. What this could be doing. People ask all the time, what Trump is screwing up, how much of this can be undone? And there is a real, the United States will always, well, at least presumably be powerful, et cetera. We are what we are. But our leadership role around the world, I think you could make a plausible argument, is diminished forever.
And you got to really ask yourself why that is, because I mean, all these things really only benefits one person.
Yeah, you know, it's funny how you look at this story and we talk about the media, and we'll be talking about the media again later in the show, and how the so-called left-wing media, which means the credible media, how it's supposedly left-wing, but it just cannot state the obvious. How they dance around what's going on, this whole thing with Trump, the whole thing with Putin.
It's almost like we're waiting for them to catch up to what we already largely know.
Right. I think to a large extent. I suppose to some extent, as you think about that, Damien, it's a good thing. Because certainly mainstream media like the New York Times shouldn't be reporting supposition. It should be reporting facts.
But you have to question why, though. You can't just say, okay, well, maybe some of this stuff is just happening just because. I mean, how many of these signs are we going to keep ignoring? You know, if these things are pointing to this possibility, then we should at least be talking about why, because it's kind of a big deal. I mean, for the first time, you could have a situation where you have this level of what could be called treason happening in the United States. So why not at least entertain it? We're gonna talk about emails, and we're gonna talk about Barack Obama's tan suit, and we can't talk about something that's really.
And we'll talk about civility, of course. While the President of the United States may be meeting his boss in Russia, we're going to talk about Sarah the Huckster being treated rudely at a restaurant. I think some of that, I don't know what to attribute that. You may have more ideas. You know a lot about the media and studied the media a lot. So you may have some ideas what's going on. I mean, some of this to me is an abundance of caution. Media is afraid of getting out in front of the story because of how the right-wing propaganda machine will be all over them.
But why be so selective? Why talk about emails and what they may or may not have? And it's even worse than that, because even when a report comes out that says, yeah, we didn't really find anything in the emails, you know, they were going on and on and on about what these emails might be. Oh, Crooked Hillary is tied to this or that. But yet when it comes to this, everybody just takes a step back, and I want to know why.
Yeah, well, there's no question, as we've talked about on the show. You make a great point. I mean, the media, first of all, the idea of dismissing the media as a liberal media, we've argued a lot, is absolutely absurd. Even where it tries to be honest, the fact that it is corporate-owned and corporate-beholden in the sense of advertising, whatever else, means that to make the argument that the media is liberal is ridiculous. But one would think that to at least some extent the media wants some kind of order, some kind of reasonable government. And you do have to go back. I mean, the New York Times has apologized for how much they did trumpet the Hillary Clinton email story when, excuse me, right before the election.
Yeah.
When so much other stuff isn't being done.
You know what they need? They need a DeLorean. We should get those guys a DeLorean so they could go back in time and undo that, because, I mean, here we are right now.
Yeah, well, they're not going to go back in time and undo it, but, it seems to me that this is now a whole bunch of times that we've heard about them apologizing for making mistakes and running one story too hard, not running the story's negative of Republicans hard enough.
But don't you think that they should be more in touch with their audience and their listeners? Because, I mean, I'm not the only one who, when you saw this on the news or when you read it in the newspaper, you're thinking, enough with the emails. I mean, wasn't it Bernie Sanders that actually said those words? Enough with the emails. I do a terrible.
I think he said enough with the damn emails, actually. We could say
exclamation.
That. This is enough with your damn emails.
Yeah.
You know, on some level, of course, you want to say that what the media mostly does is try to sell newspapers, sell airtime or whatever else. And for whatever reason, I guess the Hillary Clinton email stories were selling newspapers.
You would think that a scandal as what is seems to be imminent here with Trump would sell newspapers. And remember that stand-up comedian, Michelle Wolf?
Yeah.
When she gave that speech.
That awful, horrible person, you mean, who insulted Sarah the Huckster?
And I think everything was kind of okay with the media, with what she was saying, until she hit them. And she said, I think, exactly what you just said, which is that, you know, this has a lot to do with them selling papers, and that Trump helps them sell a lot of papers. Horse race politics, basically.
And, of course, you have to add into the fact, when we talk about the liberal media, the media is almost exclusively large multinational corporations and getting larger as we speak. And large multinational corporations don't tend to prefer liberal politics and liberal politicians.
You know, I think I had read somewhere that one of the effects of the Fairness Doctrine, and we're going to get more into the Fairness Doctrine at some point, either this show or the next show. But there was something like 50 large companies that dealt with communications when that was around. And one of the side effects of repealing the Fairness Doctrine, which was repealed by Reagan in 1987, was that went down to about 6. So, yeah, there are a few companies that certainly seems to be pulling all the strings.
Well, do you know if the New York Times is running a story on Hillary Clinton's emails before the election? Did that implicate the fairness doctrine before it had been repealed?
I don't know. I don't.
I mean, they weren't expressing opinions.
I think they're afraid to, because they always get the backlash. You know, when the fairness doctrine was repealed in 87, in 1988 is when Rush Limbaugh started a show a year after. Coincidence? No. Because after he started a show, immediately after, he started tearing into the fairness doctrine, saying that, well, it's an assault on our freedom of speech. So I think that's why a lot of people are probably afraid to bring up something like the fairness doctrine, because they always get the right-wing pushback, which is that, well, this is an assault on freedom of speech, which, of course, it wasn't.
I also think, and this will be a theme pretty much for the rest of the show, that it is, while we have a lot of criticisms of the right, which will be aired on this show and all the other ones, and the Trump administration, they seem to be awfully good at scheming. I mean, the one thing they're able to do, they have intimidated. You know that if you say something negative of Hillary Clinton, the backlash will not be that severe. But if you say something negative about the Republican candidate, the machine goes into action.
The machine. Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of people on the left, they feel like they don't really have the media, except for Nation Radio. Shameless plug. But yeah, they really don't have the media to support any semblance of common sense stuff like the right does. Because as soon as the right says something, you've got this guy talking about it on Fox News, followed by a chain of other people who are talking about it in like three different ways, but basically saying the same thing on conservative radio and other media outlets. We on the left, progressives simply don't have that mechanism in place.
Basically, that propaganda machine that can take. I had talked on this show a few weeks ago about the David Brock book a long time ago. David Brock, who was the conservative hitman who helped, apropos of today's discussion, Clarence Thomas get onto the United States Supreme Court by making crap up about Anita Hill, which he now admits to doing. And he ultimately decided he was sent to do a hit job on Hillary Clinton and decided while researching his book to target Hillary Clinton that he actually liked her and decided to switch sides and now runs MediaMatters.org and is a big Clinton supporter and wrote a book years ago, Blinded by the Right, Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. And one of the things that we had talked about a few weeks ago, for those listeners who missed that show, is the extent to which the conservative propaganda machine just feeds off of itself, how it's such an integrated whole. How Matt Drudge or some right-wing blogger will blog something that will just be opinion, innuendo, whatever, without any source, and it just moves up the chain. Everyone citing somebody else for attribution, and it's been now being reported, and it's whatever else, and nobody actually said this is true, but now it's gotten into the New York Times because it's been on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal saying it's being reported now all over the media that.
I see, but now we're going to do our listeners a great service and teach them what to look for, because there's a little bit of a formula that they use with this. If you listen closely, and you know, I would encourage anybody to at least spend like a half an hour listening to conservative talk radio. Here in New York, it's ABC 770, and in other places you'll find it too.
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt. I have to disagree with you on this one. I cannot. I respect our listeners. I'm sure if I knew them, most of our listeners, and I would never subject anybody to that. We have to share this, Nasari. We have to share this. When we started this show way back when, my producer came to me and said, I want you to listen to right-wing radio. And I said, nope. And he said, no, really, I want you to listen to right-wing radio. I want you to get a sense of what they do and how they do it and whatever for the show. And I said, nope. Mm-hmm. And this went on for a long time. I'll abbreviate this process, where you eventually sort of pulled rank on me and were like, I want you to listen to the damn right-wing radio. And I mean, you know this story. I've told this to you. I've probably told this to our listeners at some point. But one day, driving home from school, I turned on, in New York, was it ABC 77, has a right-wing, and I'm listening to somebody, I think it ended up being, I don't remember if it was Michael Savage or which of the jackasses
I think it was. Michael Savage.
And I'm telling you, I listened for 5 or 10 minutes and I said, I can't, I'm sorry, I'm going to get in an accident.
I'm serious. I'm going to intentionally, it's not going to be an accident. I'm going to intentionally run something or somebody over or crash into a tree. I don't understand how people do this. It goes back to that whole discussion briefly that we had with Gail Collins on the show several weeks ago when she appeared on the show, where she said, how come, you know, liberals make jokes and conservatives do anger? And it's like, wow, they really do anger. They do anger all the time.
It's what drives them. So what they do is they'll go ahead and assert to something that's just preposterous. And for our listeners, if you do listen to these guys, and I do recommend that you do for as long as you can tolerate it, what you'll find them asserting something that's one part of what they're talking about. Then the second part of what they're talking about is something that happens to be true, whether it's a sentiment or a fact, and they try to marry those two things together to give the first part credibility. And this is an actual tactic that they use. So they can assert something that's just completely outrageous or false, just to keep their listeners in a perpetual state of fear, paranoia, and outrage. And then they'll go ahead and just say something that you know is true. So by association, that makes the other thing true. You know, we should try that.
Correct. It has the veneer that there's something there that they can hang a hook on that sounds reasonable. You know, maybe part of the reason that they do anger, the fear, paranoia so well. You have to do that through repetition. Mm. You know, a joke, you don't have to keep hearing 100 times. You hear it and it's funny and you laugh. But in order to keep that kind of outrage up, I think that requires the kind of propaganda machine that they apparently have. And I should elaborate at this point, because I've taken a position that if it's misconstrued would be a bad position, which is you clearly should not just be getting your information from liberal, quote-unquote, media sources. You should, of course, here's a shameless plug, too, you should be listening to Forward Nation Radio, as apparently at least now you are. You should be listening to Forward Nation Radio and other sources, The Nation Magazine, et cetera, et cetera. But you obviously should be trying different sources as well, and you should be getting different perspectives. Now, when I say you shouldn't be listening to right-wing radio, I really want to clarify this. And it is, I think, an interesting question when it comes to media.
Yeah, it's the birthplace of a lot of these outrageous thoughts.
It is.
It starts on conservative radio, and then it just gets normalized through like Fox Radio and One American News and Breitbart and Alex Jones.
Right. All those that you named, the important thing being, I think, that they don't have any credibility, that they trade in lies, they blatantly lie, they blatantly deceive, mislead, etc. I'm not saying don't read more conservative columnists, more conservative points of view. But if somebody has a history of lying to you, you need to stop listening. It's not a liberal conservative thing, although it ends up mostly being a liberal conservative thing. It's not a liberal conservative thing, but to say, we've said this so often, the false equivalence here, well, you've got Rachel Maddow on the left and you've got Sean Hannity on the right. MSNBC
one
on
went
left,
to college and one didn't.
One, is that right? Yeah, Sean Hannity didn't go to college.
Sean Hannity didn't complete college.
Well, it just shows you don't have to go to college to be great. But so says the college professor. Anyway, the difference other than the college thing is that Rachel Maddow uses facts. She expresses her opinions, which the viewer can disagree with, but she bases her opinions on facts. And Sean Hannity bases his facts, quote unquote, on his opinions. And it's very different.
It's like all hyperbole over in Fox News. It's devoid of facts, a lot of it. And they actually even borrow from conservative radio, from what we just spoke about, which is that they try to marry something that's outrageous, something that's more propaganda-ish, to something that's actually existing to make it seem more credible. It's a very fascinating thing. If you go ahead and you take a look at these quote-unquote news outlets, it's really fascinating to see this at work. And it's a formula that I think everybody needs to know about.
I think to basically kind of finish the conversation a little bit on this one, you need to get different points of view, but you need to not listen to people who are not trustworthy. And you need to be able to dismiss, if they have a history of misleading, lying. I was asked, as I often am just recently, about one particular conservative commentator who fits in the category of more reasonable, at least outwardly, apparently, than Sean Hannity. Ben Shapiro, who's a favorite of many of my students, one of whom about a year ago, someone asked me what I thought about Ben Shapiro. And I said, several times students have given me things of his to read, and I've never been particularly impressed. But about a year ago, a student sent me a link and said, this is Ben Shapiro, read this. And I opened it up and I read the first paragraph. And I wrote back to the student and I said, I'm sorry, we'll discuss this in class next week, but I'm done reading it. I've read the first paragraph and I'm done. He was manipulative in the first paragraph. He was deceitful. He was clearly misrepresenting things in order to get a win in his column. And when you read that in the first paragraph, you stop reading at that point. When people have a history of lying to you, nobody should be listening to them.
Was that in your critical thinking class?
That was in my critical thinking class.
I think a lot of people don't know that you actually teach people how to be a critical thinker, which I wonder why they just don't even teach this in like middle school.
Well, thanks for the plug. I teach people what critical thinking is all about. And you're right. Well, you say it is I teach them how to go about critical thinking and try to teach the tools of critical thinking. What is remarkable is how long a process it takes to engage in critical thinking. To be able to, like, as I indicated, a lot of it is about information, which is why you need to be informed and get it from different sources. Ben Shapiro's first paragraph, I don't even remember what the hell it was, but Ben Shapiro's first paragraph, because I'm informed, because I'm thoughtful, because it was on some subject that I'm familiar with and I've given some thought to, I was able to recognize how manipulative he was being, how unfair to his reader. But obviously, for most people, it's going to work. I mean, they've learned to be really good at it. That's the way propaganda works.
Kind of like the stuff that they're using to sell this new Supreme Court judge.
Kind of like, what a wonderful segue to our next segment. Brett Kavanaugh, of course, you all must know by now, has been nominated by Trump to be the Supreme Court justice to fill the place of Anthony Kennedy. And it's something that obviously appeals to Trump. First of all, his whole reality TV mentality. I expect that Trump would have preferred to do like a Survivor miniseries with like this, you know, he would have had to raise it to like 8 candidates or something and let's put them on an island. He probably suggested it, but the Republicans wanted to make damn sure they got this guy in. And as it turns out, it was a marriage made in heaven because Donald Trump wanted to make sure that, that Brett Kavanaugh was the choice as well. We opined last week in a somewhat comedic way about what Trump's thoughtful consideration of a Supreme Court justice would be. And obviously the fact that, like everything else Trump does, there'd be no thoughtfulness to it whatsoever. We did talk about the fact that what Trump would want to know is, how do you feel about presidential immunity in one way or another? Or lots of ways or others. And it is clear already from potential future Justice Kavanaugh that he is a strong advocate of presidential immunity.
Surprise.
Surprise. Even, it turns out, from basically questioning. So Trump will figure that he will have a reliable, if they can get this guy on real quickly, he will have a reliable Supreme Court vote to say that he does not have to respond to Mueller's questions or his subpoena. So patriotism.
So
makes you all warm and fuzzy, doesn't it?
So how does that work? I mean, you've got, if the president is supposed to be above the law, why? What would be the distinguishing mark, other than the obvious, which is that, okay, you're president, but how would you write that into law so that maybe I don't go ahead and commit a crime and then expect to get off? I mean, where's the line of distinction there?
There have been a remarkable number. Again, what a sign of the times. And speaking of media, there have been a remarkable number of thoughtful and considerate and legal arguments over basically exactly that. If the president can pardon himself, if the president is immune from being indicted or having to answer questions, what, among other things, people have posed, what would stop the president of the United States from, as Trump has surmised, just murdering somebody he doesn't like on Fifth Avenue and then saying it's okay? There have been so many articles. You know, the one that comes to mind is Noah Feldman, a famous law professor who years ago, I think, wrote the Iraq Constitution after we went and overthrew that country. He has an article from, at this point, it's probably a month ago, in the New York Review of Books, examining just that issue of presidential indictment. On the other hand, you've got Alan Dershowitz making arguments on just the opposite side. But it is really a sign of the times that this is what we have to discuss right now in America, whether the president of the United States basically can commit any crime he wants and then just completely walk away scot-free.
Can I just say that while we talk about the details of whether a president of the United States or any place can do this, being above the law, let's have some semblance of common sense just kind of come in. We're talking about somebody putting themselves in an office that blocks any sort of legal action against them. They could do whatever they want. I mean, let that sink in. That's not America.
According to a constitution that was written by people whose apparent overwhelming concern was to not have a king.
I mean, it was a pretty wide ocean you have to sail over to go ahead and start something new here. And
there are some questions you sort of want to look and say, I don't care what you interpret the Constitution as. I don't care what you interpret laws as. There's just no possibility that the president of the United States is above the law and can pardon himself and is immune from indictment.
And yet here we are.
But, you know, which is something, of course, that Brett Kavanaugh famously said. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. That was when the Democrat was the president of the United States. And Brett Kavanaugh famously worked with Kenneth Starr on the Starr Inquisition of President Clinton, reminding us once again that while it is unfair to a Republican president to have a Republican special prosecutor investigating him, it is perfectly reasonable to have a Democratic president being investigated by an absolute rabid Republican prosecutor.
And you just know that people who can think at least a little bit past getting out of bed in the morning are saying, wait a minute, how is it that we have justices who are supposed to be blind in interpreting the Constitution? How is it that we have any leaning justices at all? Like, why would we have a right, left, moderate justice? Shouldn't it just be something where, you know, if you're going to stay seated during the State of the Union address because you're supposed to be all fair and neutral, why have some sort of bias? But this is a huge thing.
Well, this is a couple of things on this. Kavanaugh, of course, said the usual. When they come out with this, I love this. I have this line: judges must interpret the law, not make it. That's a big conservative line. The implication being that liberal judges make the law.
I can say words too, but if my record doesn't show that, then I mean, fool me once.
Right. Well, the one who most famously said this recently, of course, was Chief Justice Roberts. In his confirmation hearings, where he, of course, said the same thing. It's a typical Republican line. It sounds wonderful. It means absolutely nothing. It's total bullshit, but it makes the other side look bad and you look good. Roberts said, judges must interpret the law, not make the law. I understand that. We respect precedent. And then he proceeded to get on the Supreme Court and overturn every single precedent he could as quickly as possible, leading his ideological brethren, Antonin Scalia, to call him out publicly in a Supreme Court opinion and say, you're overruling all these decisions. Just say that's what you're doing already.
So what do we, is this what you teach your kids now? Because kids are paying attention. It's not important what I say, or no, just it is important what I say. That's all that's important. What I do, forget about it. It's not going to really matter. Just as long as I say the right things.
Right. Well, because by the time I do something, you'll have forgotten and we'll have moved on to 10 or 12 or 15 or 20 other lies. So it will all be a thing of the past. How many times do we go back and we analyze? We can read that, yes, Donald Trump has now passed, I don't know, how many lies since he took office? 3,000, I think, he passed a few weeks ago.
We could read that. That we know of.
But you've forgotten most of them. And when he comes out and says a lie tomorrow, that's the exact opposite of a lie he told a year and a half ago, his supporters aren't even going to remember.
Unbelievable.
They're going to just keep moving on. You know, this is the thing with the right, with the judges. It turns out, by the way, which judges are most in favor of interpreting the law, of making law, which judges are the most activist? Well, it turns out that if you actually study these issues, it is the conservative justices over the last several decades who've been quicker to overturn acts of Congress, to ban actions by the executive or others. And in fact, it has been the conservative justices who have been active. What was interesting there, and they talk about this idea, and again, the media here, there's something at least in his background that maybe Kavanaugh will be able to grow on the court. Maybe there will be some evolution there. There was something in the paper from some of the conservative players, basically, who are engineering this.
Sounds like a fungus.
It is. So we're not going to make the mistake again. The famous Souter mistake, where George Bush Sr. nominated to the Supreme Court David Souter, a justice for New Hampshire, who turned out to be a very reasonable and moderate justice. They didn't realize.
Throw it on the wall, see if it sticks.
And now John Paul Stevens, who was put on the court, I think, by Gerald Ford, and then became one of its liberal lions by the time he was done. There's a history of people getting to the United States Supreme Court and evolving. And what's funny about that is they always evolve to the left. If you look at the, there's nobody who evolves and says, well, you know, he wasn't a member of the KKK before he got to the court. But once he got to the court, he decided he would be a member of the KKK, and that would be good. You have a justice like Hugo Black, who was a member of the KKK, got to the court and became a champion of civil rights. But the Republicans have learned from their mistake with Souter, and anybody, the New York Times is even writing, maybe Kavanaugh will be better. There is no chance that this guy will be anything other than what we know him to be.
None.
There is a conservative establishment, the Federalist Society primarily, as well as the Heritage Foundation, the Alliance Defending Freedom, that is making damn sure that a Souter mistake never happens. In other words, no Republican nominee to the United States Supreme Court will believe in evolution, let alone be capable of evolution. The opinions will not change. People are talking about the fact that Kavanaugh had written it on the appeals court, the opinion that basically said that Obamacare could be constitutional under the president's taxing authority, federal government's taxing authority. An opinion that ultimately was echoed by Chief Justice John Roberts in casting the deciding vote to support, to uphold Obamacare. What's lost in that is the ability of conservatives to play the long game. And that's what's happening here. Yes, they suggested that Obamacare should be upheld at that time under the president's taxing authority. This, by the way, is the reason the Trump administration is now challenging several provisions of Obamacare, saying we've taken the tax away, we've taken the penalty away for refusing to sign up, therefore there's no tax, and therefore there's no taxing authority, and therefore there should be no Obamacare. But more importantly, what was missed in Roberts' opinion, and I'm sure in Kavanaugh's as well, is to seat upholding Obamacare in the president's taxing authority as opposed to the Commerce Clause, which for generations has been the constitutional clause that has supported federal action where it is necessary. And in fact, Roberts, and I expect Kavanaugh as well, but I know Roberts in his opinion, had specifically said the Commerce Clause does not give the president and the executive the authority to do Obamacare. And by doing that, even though upholding the taxing authority in this one particular instance, the damage that the conservatives have done to federal authority for a long time is unmistakable for those who are paying attention. By narrowly reading the Commerce Clause, we have diminished the ability of the federal government to speak. Now, one of the things, we had a conversation about the media, so we're going to leave some of this to next week, some discussion of Kavanaugh, who I'm sure will still be in the spotlight next week. But one of the things that he and every other candidate, Republican candidate, will believe in is this concept of federalism, or the states' rights aspect to that. Notice that the group that helped wean him was called the Federalist Society. And what that is a political philosophy that says the federal government should stay the hell out. We should be leaving things up to the states, which has, we've talked about before on the show, which has a certain amount of appeal. It has a certain amount of appeal until one looks at its history and understand that states' rights has been used for two purposes. One, to maintain slavery and to fight civil rights. And two, to put the power of corporations ahead of the power of regulatory authorities on the state level to regulate them. Because frequently, when a corporation is large, a state can't do it. Only the federal government can regulate. So this is, once again, all about the lack of regulation. We know, and it's become perfectly clearer, why the Republicans are tolerating the things they don't like about Trump. His international trade wars, his attacks on NATO, which undoubtedly is costing them and their clients some money. But the three things that the Republicans really wanted is court packing, killing the regulatory state, which they're doing through federalism, and lowering taxes.
And that's really important, because I think a lot of people are wondering, why are the Republicans just sitting back and allowing a lot of this stuff to go on? Well, that first point is so important. I mean, they're all important points, but they basically just want to load the courts. Imagine this. You go ahead and you strike a deal with a party, and you say, you just back me and any asinine thing that I'm going to do, and in return, I'll stack as many districts with conservative judges as possible. Well, if you're Republican, you're like, that makes perfect sense. Yes, Mr. President, go ahead and do whatever you want.
We'll take the deal with the devil.
Right, and it explains a lot of the behavior that we see, and the willingness for the Republicans to turn a blind eye to all these very serious things that are going on underneath this administration.
Well, it's helpful, as we talked about last week and last couple of weeks, and we'll be talking about again soon. It is helpful when you don't actually believe in anything except empowering yourself. You know, you talk about the court packing. It's been pointed out that Mitch McConnell has kept the Senate, will be keeping the Senate in session in August, will not be allowing the Senate its August recess. Now, there is much speculation that the reason he's doing that is he doesn't want the Democrats to be able to go home and run for re-election in their own districts. But I think that one of the other reasons why he's doing that, one of the main reasons he's doing that, is they need to keep packing the courts. And they need the Senate in session for as long as it can be in case they're voted out of office. They need to fill the courts with what they can. And what does court packing mean? It is a tragedy that the Supreme Court is, I expect, going to overturn Roe v. Wade. It will certainly eat away at its core provisions, if not actually overturning it. It is terrible what it will be doing with civil rights and voting rights, two things that our new Supreme Court nominee is not very much in favor of. But if you look at the three things that Donald Trump has promised the Republicans, packing the courts is about money. It's not the social issues that the Republican leadership really gives a crap about. That just gets their base angry. They just want the lack of regulation and the tax cuts and all the other stuff that packing the courts will allow them to do. Killing the regulatory state, that's so they and their friends could make even more money by killing people and not being told that they can't do that. And lowering taxes, clearly, just about the money. It's just money, money, money. When you believe in nothing but your own financial interests, it's remarkable how liberating that must be. Anyway, that's today's show. Thank you for joining us. Join us in the future on Spotify. Listen to us on Spotify. Listen to us on iTunes. Find us on iTunes and Podbean. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you haven't done it yet, what are you waiting for? Please share our links if you can from our Instagram and Twitter accounts. Like us on Facebook. Share our Facebook page with your friends. And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Have as good a week as you can. Until then, thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Forward Nation Radio with David Leventhal.